Let us pray. Eternal God, our Father, in whom all things were first begun, walk with us all as we begin this new day. The beauty of the morning, the light of the tireless sun, the communion of fellowship, the joy of work, and the blessing of worship, all of these come from Thee. And even as Thou hast sent us these signs of never-failing grace, continue, we pray Thee, to awaken our souls to a larger and more joyous reception of Thy loving kindness. For we are prone to blindness and easily turned from the wonder of Thy presence, and sometimes perverse in our indifference and rebellion against Thee. Keep us alert that we may never lose the wonder we first felt in the dawning of childhood, when even common things held an infinite delight. Guide our hands and train our minds and shape our souls until at last Thy glory shall be revealed in every effort we make to share in Thy work in this world. For we pray in the name of Jesus Christ our Lord. Amen. It was in the first year or two, and after I had come to Gardner Webb College to teach, when I accompanied some students from Gardner Webb to this campus for a missionary weekend, missions weekend in February. As we were driving back to Boiling Springs, I remember the students in the car were all abuzz about one particular professor that they had met while they were on the campus. They were impressed with his knowledge and command of the Hebrew tongue. They were impressed with his knowledge of the scriptures. They were impressed with his bearing in front of the students and his eloquent address. But most of all, they were impressed by the fact that he would not be allowed on the Gardner Webb campus, either as a student or a professor. Now, the reason was, you have to understand, that at that time, in our institutional life back on that campus, students and faculty were not allowed on the campus if they had beards, or if they had hair that touched their ears or their collars. Well, this particular professor had an excess of facial hair. Neatly coiffured, to be sure, but it made him ineligible to return to the very campus where he had been awarded the Distinguished Alumnus Award back in 1959. All of this is to say that my first introduction to our speaker this morning was to recognize him as a hero of the counterculture. Little did I know that I would come to know him as a colleague. Our faculty address this morning is given by Professor B. Elmore Moscoggin. I'm going to tell you what that B stands for tomorrow if you'll come back. Well, Dr. Scoggin is a native of North Carolina, contrary to what I put in your bulletin. He's from near Chimney Rock. He was educated at Gardner Webb College, at Furman University, and at Southern Baptist Theological Seminary. Okay. Dr. Scoggin is a man of wide education and experience. He served as a pastor, as a missionary, as a professor of missions on this campus 25 years ago, and then 24 years ago he joined this faculty as a professor of Hebrew and Old Testament. He has a lifetime invested in this campus and in its students. Dr. Scoggin is married to Hannah Perlman of South Carolina, who is a noted teacher in her own right and widely loved by her students. They have one child and four grandchildren who live in Nicosia on the island of Cyprus, and I suppose you'll get to see them this summer. Dr. Scoggin is widely involved in civic activities, but he's mostly known to you as an eloquent and demanding professor, and we hear him with joy and with gladness as he comes to give us our spring faculty lecture. Dr. Scoggin.
The subject on which I've been asked to speak today is the most difficult one psychologically and emotionally that I have ever attempted to address. And this is especially true of the closing section on the Holocaust. And for that reason and many others, I request sincerely and earnestly your prayerful support and understanding. About 4,000 years ago, according to the biblical record in Genesis 12:1, God said to Abraham, "Get thee out of thy country and from thy kindred and from thy father's house into a land that I will show thee." That marked the beginning of one of the most intriguing dramas in all of recorded history. It's been written in tragedy, in exile, in inquisition, in persecution, in pogrom, in holocaust, and in the constant struggle for survival. The biblical story of the Hebrew people is confirmed in its broader outlines in extra-biblical sources. And as a man of faith, I find myself asking a question about the meaning of this story for mankind. And I hope I will suggest some answers to that question as we progress today. Abraham left his home and kindred somewhere near the mouth of the Persian Gulf at a place called Ur, or Ur of the Chaldees, in ancient times, and journeyed northward and westward until he arrived in a place called Shechem, or Shechem, in central Palestine, north. As was most of the Middle East in those days, Palestine was occupied largely by tribal peoples who were often on the move. It had been occupied at various times before by different peoples, all of whom had left signs of their ancient cultures stacked like layer cakes in the tells, the artificial mounds that still dot the landscape of the ancient Near East. Abraham and those who migrated with him moved up and down between Syria and Egypt for generations before any permanent foothold was established in what we now call Palestine or the Holy Land. The best judgment of present scholars is that the patriarchal narratives, from Abraham to the conquest of Palestine under Joshua and Caleb, covered a period of some 600 to 1,000 years. It was about 1300 B.C. that the conquest phase itself began, and it was not over until the time of David or even later. Though Saul was the first king of the 12 Hebrew tribes, he did not succeed in welding them into a unity. That honor was to fall to his son and successor, or to his successor rather, David, who for political reasons as well as religious reasons conquered the Jebusite city Jerusalem and made it his capital and the seat of the worship of his God Yahweh soon after 1000 B.C. Jerusalem has never been, from that time until this, a period of 3,000 years, the capital of any other people save the Hebrews. Israel's presence on that rugged little piece of geography called Palestine has been one of constant struggle. It was seldom, if ever, peaceful. Palestine was and is today at the crossroads of the world, and it is that narrow little strip of land that joins the earth's two largest land masses, Eurasia to the north and east, and Africa to the south and the west. In ancient times, this meant that it was a highway, not only for commerce, but for military forces built on conquest. More often than not, these contesting armies met in battle on Palestinian soil. Solomon succeeded David as king of the Hebrew peoples. His grandiose schemes were so burdensome to the people that finally they revolted and divided the kingdom under Solomon's successor. This was in 931 or 922 B.C. The northern kingdom was called Israel, and the southern kingdom Judah, with its capital city as Jerusalem. The northern kingdom was destroyed and its people exiled by the Assyrians in 722. The southern kingdom struggled from crisis to crisis until it fell to the Babylonians in 586 B.C. The various occupying forces in Palestine were themselves displaced and replaced by others and superior forces. The Assyrio-Babylonians were replaced by the Persians. The Persians were supplanted by the Greeks. The Greeks gave way to the Romans. And through all of these centuries, the only permanent people were those surviving remnants of Jews who lived in Jerusalem, in Yavne, in Maron, in Modin, and in other cities, and some isolated hamlets. In 167 to 135 B.C., there was a brief period of Jewish independence under the Maccabees, but it was doomed finally to fail because of the Greek and Roman superiority. After that, the Romans were more or less benevolent despots until the revolt of the Jews about 65-67 A.D. Most vivid chapter in that tragic story was written in the heroism of the group of about 900 people under Eliezer ben Ya'ir at Masada in 70 A.D. The Romans destroyed Jerusalem and broke the back of Jewish resistance. Though there was a revolt under Bar Kokhba in 135 A.D., it was not long-lived, and the country of Palestine became a wanderer's land following the fall of Rome in 476 A.D. Christian religious life had become very active in Jerusalem and other Middle Eastern centers by the end of the 2nd century A.D., but the great temple of the Jews that was raised in 70 by the Romans was then and remains to this very day in ruins. With the birth of Muhammad in 572 A.D. and the activity that followed, the Islamic faith began to spread like wildfire in the Middle East and North Africa. And indeed, had it not been for Charles Martel in the Battle of Tours in 732, the Muslim hordes would have crossed the Pyrenees Mountains into Europe, and the whole of Europe would have been Muslim. Arab hegemony in Palestine began in the 7th century A.D. and lasted only about 300 years. The Palestinian Jews were, during those years, under Muslim control. The long struggle between the Muslims and the Crusaders began somewhere around 1000 A.D. and lasted roughly for 3 centuries. Between the Crusaders, the Seljuks, the Mongols, and the Mamelukes, the Bible lands were tossed to and fro until conquered by the Ottoman Turks in 1517 A.D. The whole Middle East, including the Christian centers, was overrun by the Muslims in the 7th century. And one of the most shameful stories in history is the story of the Crusades and the long centuries of bitter enmity between Christianity and Islam, the fruits of which we still, unfortunately, must gather. The two major exiles of the Jews back in 722 B.C. and in 586 B.C. began the process that dispersed them finally to every civilized place on earth. Everywhere they have gone, they've been persecuted and despised, again dispersed, until their descendants today live on every continent and indeed in almost every single country on the face of the earth. Back in 1517, the Ottoman Turks overran Palestine, larger Palestine, including Egypt, all the Middle East, as a matter of fact, and kept it under their unchallenged control until they were defeated by the Allenby forces, or British forces under Allenby, in 1918 at the end of the First World War. For all of these long, dark centuries, there were Jewish communities, especially religious, scholarly communities, living at various places in Palestine, including Jerusalem. In the world at large, the Jews were victims of anti-Semitism and in many places suffered violent persecutions. There were the Inquisitions in Spain, the expulsions from England and France, and finally the pogroms in Russia in the 1800s. The Jews were at home no place, really. They were wanderers in a heartless world, but their monotheistic faith sustained them, and indeed their hearts were enlivened in their annual Passover recitation of that longing hope, Hashanah haba'a b'Yerushalayim, next year in Jerusalem. This strong religious longing, coupled with the lack of peace and security anyplace, gave birth to the dream of a national homeland for all the Jews of the world who wanted one. This idea has been labeled in the modern world as Zionism. By the end of the 19th century, the idea had gained strong support, so that with the close of the First World War, the Balfour Declaration, giving the Jews a national homeland in their own Palestine, was accepted by leaders of the world in what was then called the League of Nations. The League of Nations made Britain the mandatory power over Palestine and charged Britain with carrying out the terms of the Balfour Declaration, which is one sentence long and reads as follows. His Majesty's government view with favor the establishment in Palestine of a national home for the Jewish people and will use their best endeavors to facilitate the achievement of this object, it being clearly understood that nothing shall be done which may prejudice the civil and religious rights of existing non-Jewish communities in Palestine or the rights and political status enjoyed by Jews in other lands. End of sentence, November 2, 1917. The post-World War I period and the Saudi Arabian subcontinent was in a state of upheaval because of the contest between the various Arab tribal families for control. It was partly for political reasons, but without consultation with anyone, least of all with the Jews and Arabs who were involved and who lived in that part of the world, Britain in 1922, in violation of the terms of the mandate, cut off 80% of Palestine, that is the 35,222 square miles lying east of the Jordan River, and gave it to the Hashemite family under Amir Abdullah. This was then and remains to this day an Arab homeland in Palestine, approximately 4/5 of Palestine. Abdullah later declared himself king of the Hashemite kingdom of Jordan, which is presently under his grandson Hussein. The Sinai historically never has been Egyptian. In 1892, the Ottoman Turks assigned administrative responsibility for Sinai to Egypt. And since antiquity, it had been occupied by nomad Bedouin tribes and had been under Egypt's control since the 1918 armistice. Or it has been. The United Nations assumed responsibility of the defunct League of Nations to provide the Jews with a national homeland in Palestine as promised in the Balfour Declaration of 1917. In 1947, largely as a result of a commission called the Crossman Commission, the United Nations decided to partition the remaining 1/5 of Palestine, that is the west section, west of the Jordan River, 10,000 square miles, into two states, one Arab, one Jewish. Actually, it was six states, three little Arab states, three little Jewish states, roughly divided in half. Thus, Israel was created by the United Nations in 1947, but the Arab states refused to accept the plan, and in 1948, when the British surrendered the mandate, five Arab armies marched into western Palestine and tried to wipe out the newly created state of Israel. In those 40 days following May 14, 1948, the Jordanians from the east of the river occupied what is now called the West Bank. In large part, it was the territory that had been assigned to the Arabs by the partition plan, and the Egyptians occupied the Gaza Strip. Both of these actions were illegal by the United Nations partition plan and were acts of war against the nation which was considered a member of the United Nations at that time. Following the ceasefire in 1948, Israel was in possession of approximately 8,000 square miles, actually 7,715 square miles, most of it in the territory assigned to the Jews under the 1947 partition plan. There are ample documented records, which I'll not bother to bring to your attention, in the files of United Nations archives in New York and in other places to show that the aggression was by the Arab forces from outside Western Palestine, and the 1956 Sinai campaign was the result of aggression from Egypt, and the 67 Six-Day War was the result of aggression from Egypt and Syria, as were the Yom Kippur War in 1973. In each of these, you had the specter of combined forces and supplies of more than 20 Arab states that surround Israel, warring against the tiny little state of Israel. Also, it was the force of the whole Arab civilization of the surrounding area, variously estimated at from 65 million to 160 million against fewer than 3 million people in what was at that time known as Israel. The Arab countries have a territory about 4 million square miles, considerably larger than the contiguous United States. And Israel has approximately 8,000 square miles in its own borders, about 1/7 the size of the state of North Carolina. The Arab states have huge oil wealth, abundant water, and vast amounts of arable land in their collective territories. Surely, if there's room in the area for more than 20 Arab nations, there ought to be room for one small Israeli state. Now, on the basis of this sketchy historical overview, let me now turn briefly to some current facets of the contemporary situation in the Middle East, and I hope some implications for those of us who believe. First, the West Bank. This is very much a misnomer. Everything west of the Jordan River, including all of Israel, is actually on the West Bank. The term as used in present international dialogue indicates that section west of the Jordan River that was seized in 1948 by the Hashemite Kingdom of Jordan, which you remember itself was established by the British in 1922, contrary to the League of Nations mandate, and which little West Bank section was occupied by Israel in the Six-Day War. The pressure now from the Arab states and from the PLO, as well as the Russians, is for the establishment of, quote, a Palestinian homeland on this territory. It was held by the Arabs from 1948 until 1967, as was the Gaza Strip. Nothing was said by them during those 20 years about a Palestinian homeland. In fact, if you had called an Arab a Palestinian before 1964, he would have whipped you. All Palestinians up until 1964 were Jews, or the Jews were called Palestinians. But this is just another example of what has come to be in our the context in which we operate politically as the big lie, which if repeated enough time becomes true. The fact is that the Arabs who live there now on the West Bank already have a homeland. They and their brother Arabs in Israel proper are the only Arabs in all the Middle East who have the right to vote, who are free to criticize their government, and who do not live under some form of a dictatorship or military occupation, and who are free to travel anywhere in the world they wish freely without interference or control. It is those misguided Arabs who fled the West Bank on the ill advice of their own leaders who constitute the colony called the refugees. A political Arab state on the West Bank would make the survival of Israel an impossibility. It would be a dagger plunge deep into the heart of Israel. It would leave Israel 8 miles wide at Tul Karim from the sea to the PLO Palestinian homeland. Be a base for PLO operations against Israel, and would be suicide for Israel to agree to any such arrangement, regardless of how you may feel about it emotionally. The fact remains that they couldn't survive physically, politically, if it happened. Two, illegal settlements on the West Bank, Judea and Samaria. International law, sometimes designated in the case of the Middle East as the Fourth Geneva Convention, requires that the occupying powers of any state administer those territories in prescribed ways. Occupying powers must pursue the process as they choose, as long as they do not displace or put at unfair disadvantage people residing in the territories since before the occupation. The PLO, third, is the well-organized and well-financed coalition of terrorists who represent no one but themselves, neither the Palestinians nor any Arab state, and whose covenant, published and circulated for all to read who wish to read, states categorically that the destruction of Israel is the PLO's minimum goal, and that Israel's place should be taken by a secular Arab state where those Jews who were there at the turn of the century may live as a minority. Is it to be the kind of a minority, a Jewish minority that exists today in Syria and in Iraq, whose movements are severely restricted and who are virtually prisoners, held hostage by their own governments? What is to happen to the 3 million Jews who've come to Palestine since 1900? Four, the United Nations and its anti-Israel bias. The majority of the voting members have joined the United Nations since Israel became a member in 1947. In recent years, we have seen Soviet Union join forces with all Arab-producing states, or Arab oil-producing states, and third world nations to oppose Israel, actually to exclude Israel from the family of nations in some instances, by a contemptuous disregard of the principles upon which the United Nations itself was founded. And the Russian purpose in this, if it has not been transparent in the past, ought today to be transparent. Russians and Arabs are pushing the big lie of the great Arab nation. There is no single Arab nation. There never has been a single Arab nation. Nor has there ever been an Arab nation of Palestine. Also, there's never been unity among the various Arab states outside of Palestine. They are often at war among themselves and are united only in their hatred for Israel and their determination to destroy Israel, in their encouragement of all producing nations to hold hostage all the all-using states in the world to high prices, and in their giving sanctuary to international terrorists who tyrannize the whole world. Five, the United States and Israel. The United States has made some colossal blunders recently, in my judgment, in Middle Eastern politics and diplomacy. President Carter is unbelievably naive because he intends to be a man of his word, and I think he does, and to say what he means. He tends to believe that other people do the same thing. This is certainly not true in the world of diplomacy, and it is by no means true in the world of Arab diplomacy. Muslim Arabs think another way. President Carter is not the first to fall victim to the blandishments of Arab rhetoric, but the situation is further complicated in his case, I think, because he is counseled by his national security advisor, Zbigniew Brzezinski, who comes from Poland, where anti-Semitism has long been endemic. And my own personal view is, though there certainly is grounds for criticizing this conclusion, my own personal view is that Brzezinski's advice on Israel to the president and the Secretary of State is inevitably colored by this latent anti-Semitic bias. For example, he keeps talking about leverage to force Israel to deal with the PLO. And I have searched history very carefully, and I have not found one single instance where there has ever been a case that a nation has been forced to deal with a terrorist organization pledged in blood to its destruction. This is what Brzezinski requires from Israel. Let me quote from Michael Novak, who has stood on this platform in days gone by. Everyone says that Mr. Carter is innocent of diplomatic history, but has it not even once at night occurred to the president that the Arab states controlled the Sinai and the West Bank from 1948 until 1967? Not once in those 20 seminal years did the Arab states see any need for another Palestinian homeland or a new Palestinian state. During the same years, other nations around the world integrated into their societies millions of refugees of sharply differing ethnic backgrounds, including our own nation, which we are still doing and which we right here in this community have participated in as late as this spring. The Arab nations made no gesture to integrate their own brothers and sisters. If Arab brothers and sisters did not regularize the refugees, why should they now burden Israel to do that? For 1,000 years and more, Arab peoples have borne insufferable condescension from European peoples and Westerners. Should little Israel pay for that too? Arab civilization was once the pride of the world. Scholarship flourished in Arabic while Europe lay in the night of barbarian invasion. Now that Arab wealth and power are once again commanding worldwide respect, and it's remarkable how intelligent and cultivated in the eyes of others one becomes when one's bankroll gets fat, and an end to historical condescension is long overdue. The pity shown by Mr. Carter, however, is a new form of condescension. When President Carter speaks in piteous tones of a homeland for refugees, he should realize clearly that Jordan is already a Palestinian homeland, 4/5 of Palestine, and that the refugees are indigenous people kept in the status of refugee by their own people for political reasons. These political reasons include persuading the soft-hearted to do precisely what President Carter is doing. To be sure, American motives, particularly those of the elite banking interests, are not rooted only in pity. There is tremendous wealth in Arabic, a percentage of which is coveted. There also are strategic interests in keeping Arab money in the Western camp, and, of course, in keeping control of Arab oil. The Arabs, too, have strategic reasons for staying with the West. Merchants for over 6,000 years Arab leaders know that democratic capitalism will make them far wealthier and freer than authoritarian, incompetent socialism that's found in the East and the Northeast. In 1948, Arab states refused to accept the United Nations resolution establishing Israel, and ever since they have been stubbornly intransigent. In biblical texts, Jewish leaders characterize their own people as stiff-necked. This is the word we Christians learn in Sunday school about the Jews. So it's been easy to picture the Israeli rather than the Arabs as stiff-necked. But compromises imperil Israel's survival, not the survival of the Arab states. The Arabs, who occupy 99%+ of the Middle East with 165 million people, can lose 100 wars with Israel. But Israel cannot lose but one. In fact, long Israeli interests depend on full commercial integration with neighboring Muslim nations. The Israeli do not fear harmonious and open relations. The Arab states do. Israeli skills, above all in social organization, but also in technology, could nourish vast rewards both for Israel and for her Arab neighbors. Israeli technicians, merchants, teachers, military experts, and others would tremendously enrich neighboring lands. The Near East could become the most prosperous and civilized area of all the globe. But so far, the Arabs say no. Now, what is at stake really is Arab pride, and this is difficult for a Westerner to understand, and I hope you'll try. But more than that, and deeper than that, it is the inherited vision of a Muslim sovereignty throughout the entire crescent. In the throat of that vision, Israel sticks like a stone of scandal. Often in history, the Arabs have been tolerant people. But pluralism in the modern sense, in the Western sense in which you and I understand it, a pluralism of sovereignties and of cultural systems and political liberties, is not yet a part of the Arabs' tradition. And so the deep impulse in Arab culture is to eject the state of Israel, to get rid of it. And one has to understand that to be able to think like they think. The Arabs can and will adjust to power realities, including the permanence of Israel, if they have to. It is not, after all, too much to accept. Israel comprises less than 1%, less than 1/100th of the Near Eastern territories. It's not rich in oil or other natural resources, only in its people. President Carter and Secretary Vance are falling for a ploy whose consequences for the world are incalculable. The Palestinian movement will collapse of its own weight once the leaders of the Arab world stop paying for it. Little Israel has assimilated millions of refugees. More Israeli come from Arab nations than from the West. The only way to close the Palestinian question is to recognize its artificial sources. From 1948 to 1967, the Arab nations did not establish a Palestinian homeland on the West Bank, nor in the desert of Sinai. And should Israel be expected to do what the Arabs themselves did not do? 6, the refugee question. The heart of every compassionate person should be moved at the plight of all refugees. But alas, there has been the problem of millions of Jewish refugees for more than 40 years in this century. Over 6 million of them did not even survive. And very many of those cases, it has been because no country would give them refuge. The world seemed not to care very much, and for this and other reasons, the Israeli are particularly sensitive to the refugee problem. In fact, since 1948, they have absorbed over 1 million Jewish refugees from Arab lands, and this is more than all of the Arab refugees put together. All of these Jewish refugees were deprived of their homes and of their possessions in their native Arab lands, and they came to Israel penniless. I saw 106,000 Iraqi come to Israel in 1952 and 53, penniless. Everything they owned was left in Iraq. By the official records of the United Nations, there are fewer than 600,000 legitimate Arab refugees from Western Palestine in following 1948 ceasefire. These were kept in refugee camps by their Arab host countries until their number has been swollen beyond 1 million. And in spite of their vast wealth and their enormous land resources, the Arab states have refused to absorb these refugees. And they have, in fact, used the refugees as pawns in their political game, the goal of which is the destruction of Israel. 7, the importance of the Western, for the Western world, of a democratic Israel in the Near East. Up to the time the Carter administration took over in Washington, it was the policy of our State Department to court the Arab states away from Russian sympathies. The effort was remarkably successful and was one of Henry Kissinger's crowning achievements. The larger aim was to keep Russia from gaining a significant foothold in the Middle East. But strange as it is, Secretary of State Vance invited the Russians back in and asked them to join the United States in a joint statement on the reconvening of the Geneva Conference. And in my judgment, that's just exactly parallel to asking the fox to guard the chicken house. Israel is the only democracy in the Eastern Mediterranean region. It is of vital importance to the Western world and to the United States in particular to have Israel remain free, unthreatened, and at peace in our own land. We are already hostages to the oil powers, and it gets worse by the day, as you very well know. The situation will continue to worsen, in my judgment. And a free, independent, viable Israel is absolutely necessary to our own well-being in today's world. There is finally one overriding moral question, and it's to that I wish to turn now in closing. How are we ever going to account to God if we allow Israel to be wiped out? Only the Hebrews have survived more than 4,000 years and remained a people. Those who have tried to solve the Jewish problem, either by overt action or by benign neglect, have not remained to tell the story. So if no higher motive can be found, I would say our own self-preservation is at stake. And we must see that Israel survives as a viable entity for that reason, if for no higher motive. But I have a higher motive. And at this particular season of the year, it's related to the survivors of the Holocaust in Europe in the years 1933 to 1945. And it's for that reason that those of you who are around here permanently see me wear this star, this six-pointed yellow star, from the 15th to the 27th of Nisan every year, from the beginning of the Passover to what is called Yom HaShoah. And it's interesting how the kinds of reactions that come. Have you been elected sheriff or something? Why do you wear that yellow star for a week every Easter season? What is the meaning 6 million Juden? Is it not embarrassing, that star? Why must you irritate old wounds, keep alive old and unpleasant memories? Why can't you let us forget the past and build on the future? These are just some of the questions that I get every year at this season. No, I haven't been elected sheriff of anything. I must wear this star voluntarily in the memory of those who were forced to wear it. And I must wear it until no man need ask why. Yes, it is embarrassing. It's the most embarrassing thing in all of history. My mind cannot imagine anything any more embarrassing. I must keep alive old and unpleasant memories because every future is built on the past. What Santayana said is literally true. They who forget or ignore the past are doomed to relive it. God forbid that the world ever shall see again anything even remotely like the Holocaust that is remembered at this season. Also, I must wear this star every year at this season as a memorial to more than 6 million Jews, over 1 million of them innocent little children, who perished in the Holocaust. The obscenity of obscenities to me would be for them not to be remembered by this Christian. As a Christian in more than name, one whose ideal is to follow his Lord in obedience, however far I may fall short of that high dream, I will love my neighbor and help bear his burden. And my Jewish neighbor must not be allowed to bear the burden of keeping alive the memory of the millions who perished in the Holocaust. As a practicing Christian, I must confront myself and my fellow followers of the Jew, Jesus Christ, with the disturbing questions, why the Holocaust? How could it happen? The ultimate blasphemy is the idea that the destruction of a European Jewry was God's will. God had nothing to do with it. It came right out of the bottomless pits of hell. And every true Christian knows that to be a fact. And any attempt to state Christian theology so as to make God party to the Holocaust is a perverted and a calumnious sacrilege. The New Testament states categorically that God is no respecter of persons. The Jewish problem then is not a God-made problem. It is a man-made problem. It is largely the byproduct of anti-Semitism, which itself doubtless has pre-Christian roots, but which has been kept alive for 20 centuries by Christians, aided and abetted for over 1,200 years by the Muslims. The Jewish problem, then, is a human problem. The idea of a final solution to the Jewish problem is an insult to the whole human family, and the engineers of the Holocaust are guilty of the most heinous of crimes possible against the whole human race. But I, as a Christian, must ask myself, are they more guilty than those who permitted it to take place? Are the actual perpetrators of Holocaust worse men and women than those who tolerated it and who were indifferent to it? If there is an unpardonable sin, it is the sin of indifference. Let no one understand me to say here this morning that there ever has been the equal to the Holocaust. It is the most horrible, but only the latest in a long list or a long litany of horrors visited upon the Jews by successive persecutors, Babylonians, Egyptians, Romans, Saracens, Christian crusaders, Christian Spanish inquisitors, Christian Russians, and countless millions of unnamed others who watched and did nothing to stay the brutal slaughter of their fellow human beings only because they were Jews. Now, it really grieves me to be so pessimistic, but now as I look at this very troubled present in which we live and contemplate a dismal future prospect, I must look at the Holocaust as prelude. As long as we live in a social and political context that not only tolerates but encourages national and international terrorists like the Ku Klux Klan, the resurgent Nazi parties and the PLO, megalomaniacs like Idi Amin, Muammar Gaddafi and Ayatollah Ruhollah Khomeini, world exporters of revolution and turmoil like the Russians and their Cuban puppets, and moral and political cowards like many of the leaders of Western nations, including some of our own, the Holocaust is indeed only a prelude to a more horrendous catastrophe, Armageddon. What brave heroes they are to seize the infants' building at Misgav Am, or the day school at Ma'alot and kill 18 third graders, or an apartment building in Kiryat Shmona, a little Israeli town, who placed bomb in the public market, poor folks' market in Jerusalem, or a Tel Aviv bus station where the poor have to ride, who attack a bus on a public highway, or march in Nazi uniform through a community of Holocaust survivors in Skokie, Illinois. But are they more despicable than those oil-producing Arab states that finance the PLO with millions and millions of dollars annually? Or than the Iranian mullahs who exact $2 extra from every barrel of oil they sell us so that they can support the PLO? Are they in turn any more at fault than those rudderless Western nations who abandon ethics and morality to political expediency and peddle their most sophisticated tools of war to these same Arab states whose actual defense needs are minimal and who make those weapons available to the marauding, murdering killers? By the way, we ourselves have sold $24 billion worth of arms to Saudi Arabia. And that's enough arms to arm all the NATO nations. If we wiped out everything they've got, we could arm every one of the NATO nations with better arms than they now possess, and the Saudis would still have more than they could use. This same morally and ethically deficient international climate makes possible the peddling of pious piffle about human rights in a way that involves no real risks. Has it ever occurred to the leaders of the Western nations that in the ultimate sense, the Jews of the world are human and that they have rights, including the right to selfhood and peoplehood and nationhood? Or have we given in finally to the Goebbels thesis that the Jews really are subhuman? They're just animals. It certainly would seem so when we are roused to righteous indignation over the idea of an Israeli Jewish resident in Hebron in 1979 while forgetting that Jews were massacred in that same town in their own homes by the hundreds in 1929. Has the world had its conscience seared over so completely that it will fall for the double deception that indeed the Jews are a non-people while the Palestinians are a people? How unhistorical and ill-informed can Brzezinski, Vance, and Carter be? The Israeli have no rights to settle on the so-called West Bank, even on public lands, some of which lands they formerly owned and to which they have historical rights dating back 3,500 years. The Russians, however, have rights to Latvia, Lithuania, Transylvania, Estonia, Poland, East Germany, Czechoslovakia, Hungary, Romania, Cuba, Ethiopia, Yemen, Syria, Afghanistan, and I predict next Iran and Pakistan. And in spite of all of this, not in one single instance do the Russians have historical rights in these places? Why do not the Americans and their allies direct their righteous indignation against these big international bullies? Why not Camp David meeting between the Hungarians and the Russians? Why not one between the Poles and the Russians? How about one between the Russians and the Czechoslovakians? How about one with the Russians and the Afghanistanis? It's much easier to push a little country around, especially if there's an underlying, though sometimes subconscious, feeling that this people, Israel, is really a non-people, or to use Toynbee's phrase, fossil. I declare to you in fear and trembling that unless we Christian people, and I don't mean just Baptists if we are Christian, but I mean Christian people the world over, unless we Christian people decide, no matter what the cost, to practice the gospel of Jesus Christ, which we preach so piously, unless we demand that the leaders of the so-called Christian nations of the earth conduct the affairs of their nations by the very highest ethical and moral standards of the Judeo-Christian ethic, then not only was the Holocaust just prelude, it was only the opening bars to the death dance of the human race. Now, is the alternative despair? Have we gone so far down into hell's abyss that the way is irreversible? Edmund Burke's statement comes to my mind, the only thing necessary for evil to triumph is for good men to do nothing. Well, that is one sin I will not bear. I will not be guilty of doing nothing. Under 2 months ago, I stood, as I do every February, albeit this past time when 12 inches of snow, before the Yad Vashem Holocaust Memorial on the outskirts of Jerusalem on Har HaZikaron, or the Mountain of Remembrance. And every year I take about 50 or more young ministers and their accompanying friends as the last official stop on a study tour of Israel to this Holocaust Memorial. It's always heartbreaking for me and traumatic, and as a matter of fact, I tell you quite without any shame that it breaks me down in sobs. But I come away each time with new determination and new hope. And here's what makes that possible. First, that memorial demonstrates that even in the darkest day of man's history, there are a few righteous and good people who oppose evil at any and all costs. And though their number was pitifully small and during the Holocaust, there were those righteous ones who are remembered by the little memorial grove at Yad Vashem. And there I renew my covenant annually with God and with every surviving Jew that I will never give up. 2. At Yad Vashem, I join again in renewed commitment with all good people, Jews and non-Jews, who are determined that the world shall never forget the Holocaust. 3. My testimony is made, and I hope dramatically on that spot every year to a company of young ministers, and through them I hope to many more Christians in an ever-widening circle, that our Hebrew religious forefathers were right when they taught us early in Genesis that we are all one humanity and that we are our brother's keepers. 4. I find inspiration in the young heroes of today who endure unimaginable hardship and suffering to stand for what is right under God. And one of these who inspires me deeply is Anatoly Sharansky, 30-year-old Jewish victim of a Russian show trial in July of 1978. And his crime was that he exposed the Russian failure to live up to the Helsinki Agreement on Human Rights. And when he stood to receive his sentence, 13 years at hard labor in a Siberian camp, he made the following statement, and I want to quote it to you. 5 years ago, I submitted my application for exit to Israel. But I am further now from my dream than ever. It would seem to be a cause for regret, but it is absolutely otherwise. I am happy. I am happy that I lived honestly in peace with my conscience, and that I never compromised my soul even under threat of death. For more than 2,000 years, the Jewish people, my people, have been dispersed. But wherever they are, wherever Jews are found, every year they have repeated, Hashanah Haba'ah Birushalayim, next year in Jerusalem. Now, when I am further than ever from my people, from my wife Avital, facing many arduous years of imprisonment, I say, turning to my people, to my Avital, Hashanah Haba'ah Birushalayim. Next year in Jerusalem. Finally, referring again to the ancient truth of Genesis chapter 10, that we are indeed all one humanity. Let us renew our covenant again with our religious forefathers and their heirs of our own day, and say with them, be strong, and let us strengthen each other. Hazek, hazek, we need hazek.
You will have opportunity tomorrow morning at 10 o'clock in Appleby Chapel to dialogue further with Professor Scoggin about his address, to respond to him, to hear more of what he would have to say. I encourage you to be there and to bring others with you. May we stand now for the benediction. We give thee thanks, our God, for a disciplined mind, for a life dedicated to a love of truth, for insight born out of experience, for compassion born out of love. And now may the God who created and loved you fill you with all joy and courage, so that by the power of his Spirit, you may abound in hope. Amen.